I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. From state senator and representative to healthcare and education, Charlie Shields has almost done it all when it comes to public service. Today, he's here with us to talk about his position as CEO of Truman Medical Centers and as the president of the Missouri Board of Education. We'll ask him what the future holds for public schooling in Missouri and about the Republican stronghold in Jefferson City. Then, many are observing Veterans Day today. We'll hear from a Kansas City group of veterans who are coming together through writing, hear their prose and poetry, and their stories of recovery and respite. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Charlie Shields is one of those guys who always seems to be doing four things at once, and you wonder how he does it. For the purposes of today's interview, we'll talk to Charlie about his job as president and CEO of Truman Medical Centers and his work on the State Board of Education, which has been much in the news in 2018. We probably won't have time to get to his involvement with the Missouri Hospital Association, the Chamber of Commerce, the Civic Council, Metropolitan Community College Foundation Board of Directors, the Urban Neighborhood Initiative, Truman Heartland Community Foundation, and the Starlight Board of Directors. Maybe we'll get to those in a subsequent interview. For now, Charlie Shields, welcome. So good to have you here.
You bet. It's great to be here.
How do you juggle it all, Charlie?
Well, I'm one of those people that probably my wife would say has late onset ADHD. So it all seems to work. And I try to pick things I'm involved with that ultimately connect back to Truman.
You know, let's turn to Truman Medical Center, which is your primary focus as president and CEO. What is the state of the hospital these days? How's it doing?
We're really in very good shape. It's one of those places that is an exciting place to be a part of right now. We serve two main roles in this community. We serve, obviously, as the Academic Medical Center for UMKC, School of Medicine, Nursing, Pharmacy, and Dental. That's important. But the other big role, which is why we were established back in the mid-70s, is this community's safety net hospital. Hmm. And that's a role that we embrace and we take very seriously. And we're always reminded that Kansas City benefits from having a safety net hospital. It's the only true safety net hospital in the state of Missouri. There's not an equivalent in St. Louis, and we believe that that role enables us to serve not only the citizens, but we improve the entire health market in Kansas City.
You know, one of the biggest challenges you face, Charlie, is uncompensated care. Tell us about that, and what percentage of your care is uncompensated, and how does the hospital manage all that?
So if you look at our patients. So roughly 25% of our patients lack insurance, and they come to us.
And that's a heavy percentage.
It is. It's much more than any other hospital in the state. So if this year, we're into the second quarter of our fiscal year, if that holds true, we will do $148 million of uncompensated care at cost. And to put that in perspective, that's somewhere between 12 and 13% of all the uncompensated care in the state takes place at Truman Medical Centers.
Wow. How do you cover that?
Well, we're very fortunate in that we have support from a community that enables us to do that. So we receive funding from the city of Kansas City.
There's a tax levy of some kind.
We do,
right?
A health levy. And we also receive support from Jackson County. And our agreement with those municipalities and county is that we'll serve patients regardless of ability to pay that live within those jurisdictions. So we do that. We also get this convoluted thing called disproportionate share hospital payments from the state and federal government, then a number of other funding streams, and we cobble all that together, and then we're very good at what we do, and we're very efficient, and that's what enables us to do that.
This notion that your uncompensated care totals roughly 25% here, to what extent did the Affordable Care Act affect that percentage?
Well, I think what we see happening is that when the healthcare exchanges came in with the navigators and people that were really wanting health care insurance, been blocked out because of pre-existing conditions or they were in certain age cohorts or things like that, they jumped in, and the subsidies were very helpful, and we had navigators to help them get signed up and everything. But I think that's kind of reached its peak, and now we don't see as many people enrolling in the exchanges. So I think that's where the uncompensated care continues to rise for us. The other reality is, everybody knows, Missouri is one of the now 14 states that has an expanded Medicaid. So what we see are a lot of people that aren't Medicaid eligible because, you know, their income is slightly higher.
Slightly higher than the poverty rate.
They may be
rate,
working,
yeah.
You know, relatively low-paying jobs but have significant health needs, in many cases very complex health needs, and they come to us, and that's where we're seeing the growth.
How would expansion of Medicaid in Missouri change your world?
Well, I think it would dramatically reduce the level of uncompensated care of the patients that lack insurance. I think more important would be we would start to see patients who come to us late in their disease state because they would have access to primary care through Medicaid. Maybe the complexity and the severity of their illnesses would decrease as a result of that.
I gather you favor Medicaid expansion?
I do, but I'm also very cognizant of the challenges that, you know, our state legislature faces with budget issues as you look at that. So I think there's probably a pathway that maybe not full-blown Medicaid expansion within the next legislative session, but could the legislature look at certain vulnerable populations and bring them in as you move towards that?
Do you sense any political will to do what you just described? Because just generally speaking, I guess I'm not sure I do.
Well, I think so. I mean, the populations that I look at and I've had discussions with lawmakers about, the example would be military veterans who don't qualify for VA benefits because they didn't serve long enough or can't prove that their illness was related to their
right.
service. That would be a population to bring in. The other would be, and the legislature's looked at this, would be young people suffering from some behavioral health diagnosis. Because the problem is right now that you take a young person who has severe mental illness or behavioral health issues, they end up getting care at some point. Eventually, as their disease state progresses, they either become totally and permanently disabled and they qualify for Medicaid, or unfortunately, they end up in the correction system. So mm-hmm. if we can get to that population sooner, I think that's an opportunity. And I think also policymakers understand there's a connection probably to gun violence is related to that population. And they may look at that while, you know, Second Amendment rights are very challenging for the state legislature to address. Maybe you can address gun violence by bringing in that younger population that's suffering from behavioral health issues.
I'm visiting with Charlie Shields. He's the president and CEO of Truman Medical Centers. You know, as a former policymaker, and when we talk about health care broadly in terms of how it impacts the country, what approach makes the most sense to you? I mean, is it the individual mandate, Charlie? Is it Medicare for all? Where should we be going? What should we be thinking about here?
Well, I don't think you're going to end up with Medicare for all anytime in the near future. No.
I wouldn't think so.
Maybe
either.
30 years down the road, it's hard to say that. But I think what I believe sincerely is that the most efficient healthcare system is about having all the population in some form of coverage. So whether that's in the exchanges, whether it's traditional commercial insurance, whether it's Medicare, and also add to that Medicaid. If you can get people into coverage, what you end up eventually is a more efficient system because you're mm-hmm. driving care, you know, further down in the disease state. So right now our system in Missouri, you know, people get care, but ultimately it's care when they come to us very late through the emergency room, and then it ends up being very, very expensive on the back end.
I'm wondering, how does violence in our town impact the work that Truman does every day?
So we have three level one trauma centers on the Missouri side. So St. Luke's, Research, and Truman. Of that, obviously Truman would be the largest of those level one trauma centers. So what we've seen in the past 2 to 3 years, we've seen in 2016 to 2017, we saw an increase in violent trauma, what we call intentional violence. That's about 36% of the trauma that we see in the organization. Now, interesting enough, this year we've started to see a slight decrease in that. It's hard to say, is that going somewhere else, or have we actually seen a decrease in the level of violence? But clearly, in the level of trauma that we see in the organization, and we see it every day, and I know your guest from Children's Mercy talked about that.
Right.
You know, it's part of what we see in this community. Now, we're obviously well-equipped to deal with it, and we understand that. But 36% is a big number, what we see coming through the ED in terms of trauma.
How does your staff sort of manage that kind of caseload, that regular caseload, maybe even from an emotional, psychological standpoint? This is so much of it is so senseless, and it makes up such a big chunk of what you guys do.
Well, I think what I see is in going out and talking to patients, I mean, clearly the emergency department, the surgical services, all our trauma team, they can deal with that as well as the inpatient side. So the challenge, I think, what people don't realize is when you go out and visit these victims of violence is that, you know, many times, I mean, they are disabled for life as a result of that violent episode. And that's the part I think a lot of people don't realize. It's not what just comes into the hospital. It's what happens after they leave the hospital. Somebody that, you know, is no longer able to work, no longer able to care for family, in many cases needs assistance just for the, you know, daily living things. And that's the part of trauma and part of violence that a lot of people don't understand and don't see.
Yeah. Let's turn to your work on the State Board of Education. I mean, you guys have had quite a year since the firing of the former longstanding education commissioner. Her name was Margie Van Deven. You're even getting close right now to finally getting a new education commissioner. Where does that process stand? Because recent news reports said even by Thanksgiving you might have a new one in the saddle here.
So during the month of October, we actually received applications and nominations for the position of commissioner. And we received 12, which was, and I can tell you, they were all highly qualified. So while it wasn't a big number, it was a quality number of applicants. We actually took that number down to 4, and then we will actually interview all 4 of those applicants next Monday. Huh. And then I would anticipate we'll make a decision, you know, possibly Monday or Tuesday on who that person is. Likely will not be able to announce that because, you know, they'll have to notify their current employers depending on the situation.
Right.
The idea would be that we would have a commissioner in place right immediately after the first of the year.
Is one of those applicants, can I ask, is it Margie Van Deven?
Well, obviously I agreed to keep all those confidential, and I'd love to be able to answer that question, but I can't.
What impact has the lack of an education commissioner had? I know you've had an interim, but what's been the price?
Well, I think from the standpoint of education policy and moving education forward, we kind of took a hiatus. Remember, the board didn't meet for 5 months because we didn't have a quorum.
I remember.
Now, what I will say is the interim commissioner, Roger Dorson, who has long experience in education in the state of Missouri, has done a fabulous job and kept the core group of senior leaders intact at the department. So I think the department's operated very, very well. What we need to, though, is look forward and how do you advance education policy. And that's a function of both having a quorum on your board. We have now 7 of 8 members, and give Governor Parson credit. That was the first thing he did when he became governor, is restore the Board of Education. Between the state board and the commissioner, ultimately, I think we'll be able to move forward on some of the issues that are facing us in education.
There are lots of concerns about a delay in the reporting of student test scores. You know, these tests were taken last spring. Mark Bedell, the superintendent here in Kansas City, still doesn't have the results in English and math, as you know. As a result, he says he's not able to adjust the curriculum to address any shortcomings that the tests might have revealed here inside his district. What's taking so long?
Well, the challenge is we have, you know, you have to go back in history. So we have a new assessment. You know, Missouri moved away from Common Core.
There've been more than one here.
And well, yeah, there's been a series of new assessments. So we finally have the results of those assessments that the students took last year, and then trying to figure out what they call the cut scores to describe who's below basic, proficient, and advanced has been the challenge in getting an agreement on that. So I think we're there in terms of agreement. And then you'll see what they call the annual performance report will come out February 1st, and then Dr. Bedell will know where his district stands in that. His challenge and the thing he's intently interested in is gaining full accreditation, and the APR will enable us to make that decision as a state board.
What's your sense? How is the Kansas City, Missouri School District going? Obviously, such a big concern here in our city. What's your sense, Charlie?
Well, I think they're going the right direction. Clearly, Dr. Bedell is a dynamic leader and is doing a fabulous job. I think there are challenges that they face, and I think the challenges, you know, that balance of, you know, the school district and the charter schools, and that may just be a growing pain kind of thing because other communities have gone through that. But they got to reach that balance and figure out who's doing what and everything. But I think they're headed the right direction. And, you know, my hope is that, you know, after we get the APR scores back 1st of February, we'll be able to move them next spring to full accreditation. And that's a big transformation that's taking place over a number of years.
Now, you think it could happen next spring?
I do. So last year they had the points. And this year, you know, what we looked at is, you know, can you sustain it for 2 years in a row? And that's my hope, is that when we get those scores back and figure out where they're at on the annual performance report, that they've done that for 2 years in a row and we can move them to accreditation, which, you know, those of us who have been around Kansas City for a long time know that is a big move.
Now, absolutely. The latest thinking in town has been that it might take another year or two. What I'm hearing you say is it might be sooner than that, assuming the test scores are what you hope they are.
Yeah, so if we see test scores and the APR 2 years in a row meeting the criteria for full accreditation, which is 70 out of 100, then I think the board would be inclined to give full accreditation back to that district.
What would that mean for the Kansas City, Missouri School District, Charlie, after all these years of struggle?
Well, I think a couple things. One, it shows clearly that they have made progress. When you go back, you know, I think a lot of it started under Dr. Covington and then moved to Dr. Bedell, but he's continued to push it forward. So they've made progress. The other thing I think is, it from a community standpoint, it shows that there's some faith in the education system that – you know, people moving into the district, moving into Kansas City, the old school of thought was that when you had an underperforming school district, you had to make other choices. And I think, you know, maybe this sends a different message to our community that you don't have to make other choices. There are viable choices in the charter school community, but there are equally viable choices within the Kansas City, Missouri Public School District.
I mean, this town might do a ticker tape parade if this district is fully accredited here, Charlie. This would be a big deal.
It is a big deal. And like I said, I have a long history around this because
yes.
I'm a product of that school district. And I think it would be a day of celebration. I also think, and maybe the third thing is for the staff of that school district, it would be very affirming in terms of the work that they're trying to do.
I know one of the issues that the state board has had is this whole idea of attendance and some students just not enough students attending school as often as they need to be to meet state standards. There's been a huge push, as you know, inside the district to sort of get its arms around that and make strides forward. And you get a sense that that's happening.
I do. And what we see, not just in Kansas City, but statewide, you know, that's really driven at the building level, and we've seen, you know, amazing innovative ideas from building principals encouraging students to be at school and be at school on time. And it's really kind of, you know, when you look at that work, this idea that, you know, you have to be in school to learn, and they've put a big emphasis on that. So it's not just Kansas City, that's statewide.
You know, as a reporter and an editorial board member at the Star, I've spent some time with Dr. Bedell and his staff, and again, getting a sense of what the district is up against. When you spend time and you watch them and you begin to appreciate exactly some of the challenges they're facing, you know, you do change your whole sort of attitude towards the district. You know, the easy sort of response to Kansas City is, oh, it's a lousy school district. But, boy, it's so much more than that.
It is, and they do amazing work. And, you know, one example, you know, a couple of years back we visited schools in the district, and I always point out we went to a very affluent suburban district and saw high-performing kindergartners. I mean, these were children that were, you know, 2 months into kindergarten in the fall, and they were doing amazing things. Then we went to actually one of the charter schools within Kansas City, but it was Kansas City Neighborhood Academy, which is a district-sponsored charter school. It's all the same age group that were struggling with much more rudimentary activities. So you realize that we're not starting at the same place with many of these children, and you know, that goes perhaps to, you know, the early childhood opportunity that they have. But then you take that and look at what the district's able to do. And then I think the district is also very cognizant, you know, that they have students, you know, 175 days out of the year and 7.5 hours of the day, but they've got to work within the social context of Kansas City. So they've spent a lot of time, you know, working with the social service agencies in this community to try to create opportunities for solutions around some of the challenges those children face. And that's what I think has made the big difference in the district is working outside of the four walls of the schools, but getting out in the community and understand the challenge that these students face coming to school every day.
You know, you alluded to the early childhood education piece that Mayor Sly James is pushing so hard, has talked about so much. How important of a step do you think that would be from your vantage point on the State Board of Education for the city to go that direction?
Well, let me just put it in context. So one of the four goals of the State Board and the State Department is every child enters kindergarten ready to learn. And we think there has to be a quality early childhood program in place and that opportunity for children to succeed. And, you know, I go back to that story I told. I mean, it is clear the difference that makes in children and the payoff that that has down the road, because it reduces the level of remediation and things that we see, you know, in grades 3 and 4. When we have early childhood opportunities. So I think it's a significant push. I think obviously there's a lot of questions around, you know, what this community is going to do about it and what mm-hmm. the state's going to do about it. But I don't think there's any question that if you want to improve education in the state and educational performance, you have to provide quality early childhood education.
Do you have a sense, Charlie, that the governor and this General Assembly, is there interest in pushing an early childhood piece forward?
Well, we've seen in the past that the General Assembly has moved the bar forward, because what they did 3 years ago would say that, you know, once the formula was fully funded, then you could start to fund 3 and 4 year olds, particularly in high need areas. So there's a commitment from the legislature on this. Governor Parson, I think, is intensely interested in early childhood. Now, we know, you know, the budget constraints that the state is under, but I think you'll continue to see an acknowledgement that this can make a big difference and improve education all along the spectrum.
You know, moving outside of just the Kansas City School District for a moment, as you know, a sizable group of superintendents in the state are concerned about standard tests in Missouri and this concern about teaching to the test. A story in the Missourian from earlier this year pointed out that Rockwood School District Superintendent Eric Nost said that standardized testing really squelches the very creativity that we need in our classrooms, but offers nothing in return. What about that?
Well, I think there's a balance that you have to reach, and we're trying to figure out what that balance is.
Right.
So people want, and citizens of this state demand accountability for the school districts. They want to know, are we doing our job? And is the state doing its job? Local school districts doing their job? Assessments are part of that. They're not all of that, but they're a part of that. But also, we need to be quick to understand there is a challenge of over-assessment. And, you know, state mandates, Missouri Assessment Program test called MAP test and end-of-course test. Local districts do their own testing. Test fatigue is probably a real issue. So I think we'll continue to struggle to reach that balance. But the fact that we're aware that there needs to be a balance probably will move us in the right direction.
You know, how did you get involved in education policy? Because I bet you've thought at times that, hey, overseeing the state Senate in Missouri is one challenge, but education policy is just, it's an octopus that never ends here.
Well, two things. One, I served on a local school board for 16 years, so I've been around it. Have a wife who was a teacher, mother was a teacher, so I've been around education all the time. But more from a healthcare standpoint, the thing I always look at is, you know, if you want to improve the health status of the community, the number one determinant of your health status is your economic status, and the number one determinant of your economic status is your level of education. So there's a connection between my day job and my so-called volunteer job with the state board, is that if you really want to improve the health of the community, you got to improve education.
You know, you've wondered at times in recent years if lawmakers sort of understand that. I mean, at times there's been a lack of financial support for higher ed. At times the funding for public schools hasn't been what a lot of educators wanted it to be. Is that changing?
Well, if you look, this legislature has fully funded the foundation for it 2 years in a row, and I think that is a major statement about where the priorities are. And I anticipate, even though we're in difficult financial times in the state to a certain degree, I think they'll continue to fully fund the formula. So this legislature, this governor, I think, get that. They're going to move us in the right direction.
You served in the General Assembly for many years, and again, you finished your career as the president pro tem of the state Senate. What things did you learn as a lawmaker that you still use in your professional life?
Well, I think, you know, certain things is that, you know, one thing, you know, as a CEO that I've learned is that, you know, as long as you don't care who gets credit for something, that makes a lot of difference.
Well, and that matters a lot in Jeff City, doesn't it?
Senate Pro Tem, that was a big part. and then the other is to be able to put yourself or put your colleagues in a position to succeed. So people get confused of why people elect leaders in the House or the Senate. They don't elect them because they want the leader to have all the great ideas. They elect them because they want to help push their ideas and make them successful. So I think those are things that are very important. The challenge I think that the General Assembly has, and particularly in an era of term limits, is it's very difficult to think, you know, what do the solutions look like that make Missouri successful 10, 15 years down the road, because it's kind of a short-term kind of thinking. And I think that may be a result of term limits, and, you know, that's probably a discussion for another day. But
you know, just a final point, your party, the Republican Party, is now once again ascendant in the state of Missouri. Why is that, do you think? What's happened in the state that it's, in my career, it's shifted from a strong Democratic state to one that is equally strong or even stronger, a Republican state?
I think what we've seen, particularly in the legislature, is the loss of the outstate rural Democrats. You know, areas that were solidly Democrat, you know, the Ozarks, Southeast Missouri, are now solidly red. So you can attribute that to a number of different things, you know, maybe changes in philosophy and the ideas of the Democrat Party moved a little bit too far to the left for that population around, you know, Second Amendment rights and abortion rights issues. What I always remind my former colleagues and people now serving in the General Assembly, you know, I was there in 1992 when Democrats, you know, had five of the six statewide offices, had majorities in the House and the Senate. Things can change, and always be cognizant that you need to be responsive to your constituents because things can change and will change in Missouri.
That's Charlie Shields. He's president and CEO of Truman Medical Centers. Charlie, great conversation. Thanks for coming in.
You bet.
I sure
Happy
appreciate
to be here.
It. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about veterans writing stories. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Friday on the show, Kansas Governor-elect Laura Kelly talked about the future of education funding, Medicaid expansion, and bipartisan government in Kansas. Hear that conversation and other previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, Greg Eklund's in the House to run down some of the big sports stories going on in town right now that'll likely include Sporting KC's playoff run. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, what's one way to deal with military combat? How about writing about it? Now a conversation with veterans who went through a five-week writer's workshop where they learned how to put their military experience into words that they will present on Tuesday night at a public reading in town at the Kansas City Public Library. With us, Nick Lopez is a veteran and a poet. He spent 8 years in the U.S. Marine Corps, including time in Iraq. Nick, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Steve.
Dolores Mays is also a poet. She joined the U.S. Army in 1976 for 3 years of active duty and then put in another 3 years with the Army Reserve. Dolores, nice to have you, too. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
Sydney McDermott is a member of the team organizing the event, and she served for 20 years in the Navy. Cindy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, Cindy, give us a brief overview of what the workshop offered these veterans here.
Well, we had five Saturday sessions beginning September 15th.
It was a commitment then, wasn't it?
It really was. We were about 3.5 to 4 hours each time we met. The first time we did the Brian Turner interview, which mm-hmm. you were so kind to help us with that.
Yeah.
And that was a six-hour session, but we were going over tips and tools and techniques to help the veterans write their stories.
Dolores, that's a big commitment of time.
Yes, it was.
How was it for you?
Well, it was really quite nice to sit there, and since this is really the first time I've ever written anything other than instruction manuals, it was fun.
A little different kind of writing that you're doing now than instruction manuals, eh?
Definitely.
But why did you want to do it?
Well, I really hadn't had much time, spent much time with veterans after I got out of the military. We have a few people who are at the office, but I thought that this might be an interesting writing experience. And it's always nice to learn something different. And I did.
Nick, how about you? Why did you want to be in this workshop?
I went to the fall workshop last year and have really worked closely with Cindy and H.C. Palmer And so I wanted to continue working on my skills. Before, I never really shared any of my poetry with anyone. It was kind of a personal thing. So
yeah. How big of a leap was that for you, going from not sharing those personal thoughts to something very different?
I would say first it was very intimidating.
Yeah.
but there's a great group of people with the Kansas City Veterans Writing Team that, you know, kind of lead me on the way to be able to express that without that fear.
I was going to say, how did you overcome the fear? How was it? How did you manage that?
I think just rolling with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you get in front of a microphone like a talk show host one day and you just start talking and away you go, right? Yeah. You just got to do it. Cindy, how did these vets get into the writer's workshop? I mean, did they have to apply and be selected or just sign up? How did that work?
The vets and family members, too. So veteran family members could also participate. And we just use the media, you know, great programs like yours, yeah, and through the library itself. So we have worked with the Plaza Library, and we've also worked with the Mid-Continent Library as well. And they do nice email blasts for us and just get the word out. And on average, we'll have 30, 35 vets that and family members that sign up to join us each time.
How much interest out there in the veteran community is there in this kind of program?
I think there's a lot of interest, but I think there is the barrier that we have to get over that I'm a military member and I'm a big burly guy or a gal or whatever, and I'm going to use writing as a tool to help me tell my life experiences. Mm-hmm. And then secondarily, that we hope we help them heal from some of those experiences as well. So it's kind of, you have to get past that I'm going to use writing or I'm going to use poetry and be engaged in it as part of this process.
Yeah, I'm wondering, were there any worries about what emotions and memories might be stirred up by, you know, from those participating here? Or was that the point, to find a way to address them and to find a place to put all these things?
Steve, that's always a concern, but it's not one where we would want to stop or prevent a veteran from sharing those kinds of stories. So mm-hmm. we always encourage it. And then I think just being in the group and the camaraderie of being with other right. past or present military members means a lot to a vet who might be experiencing something that is greatly troubling in his soul.
You know, Dolores, you said you'd never done this kind of writing before. How was it for you sort of opening yourself up in the way Nick described? How did that work for you?
Well, it worked very well. What I found is that I could write some of this stuff pretty quickly, but it was a interesting process because it brought back memories from the time that when I was in the military, which has been quite a few years, as you could tell. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed learning a new skill.
Were there things that you hadn't dealt with much before this process?
Well, one of the poems that I wrote was about my brother who was in Vietnam. And I had forgotten that memory until I actually sat down and started writing it.
And what was the memory, can I ask?
Sure. He was the man from GLAAD, which is part of the group that deals with body retrieval when he was in Vietnam. And he did several tours of it. And
he was called the man from GLAAD.
That is the jargon that's used for that group who do that duty, yes.
That's a hard job.
Yes.
Does he talk about it much?
He only talked about it one time with me, and we've never talked about it since.
But still, you wrote about it, though, eh?
Well, when we were talking with the other veterans, it seemed like a story that seemed to fit in, and a poem that had a lot of emotion, and it seemed to fit with what we were talking about with combat and the effects of combat.
You know, we're talking with veterans here about a 5-week writing program. They just went through learning how to write maybe in a different way. And I was wondering if Dolores could read that poem, A Man from GLAAD, here in just a moment. I want to let our listeners know that they can enjoy an evening of poetry and prose read by Kansas City area military veterans and veteran family members. This will be at 7 o'clock tomorrow night, Tuesday evening, at the Plaza Library. To RSVP or to get more information, you can go to kclibrary.org. Dolores, would you read Man from GLAAD for us?
Sure. My brother told me about his time in Vietnam. with quiet words and gestures and silence. Three tours until I couldn't take it anymore. Once again, silence. So many bodies, so many days, he said. Other soldiers told me his job was the man from GLAAD, an unkind use of a slogan from a plastic bag commercial. I never asked if he was that man. We never broke the silence.
Hmm. Obviously hard for him to talk about, too, then.
Yes.
Yeah. Nick, you brought a couple pieces as well.
Yes.
Would you read one of them to us? Maybe Lost Words here?
Lost Words. Home from the deserts of the Middle East and the war with no end, he now resides on Suburban Street, USA Town, zip unknown. The warped white picket fence with the gate left open to the unkempt yard. Hope for the return of a wife long gone. The curtains drawn to hide the forgotten dream of children's laughter. The lights dimmed so the residents may live within the shadows of grim. 6,000 miles from the combat zone, but he lays in bed till the afternoon, captive to his own mind. Only words he now knows, name, rank, serial number, and date of birth. The rest spoken in his mother's voice, her life now committed to find the lost words for him.
Man, that's tough. Grim. What are you trying to say there?
I think there, a lot of veterans are forgotten, and there's no one there to give them a voice.
Yeah.
This particular piece is, I work with veterans through my job at the VFW National Headquarters. And I mean, this is real life. There's a veteran out there who can't speak for himself, and his mother has to speak for him, and that's tough.
How are we doing as a society these days, do you think, recognizing our veterans? Because, you know, a big deal at the Chiefs game yesterday, you know, people stand up and applaud much more so than when I was a kid in college. I mean, it seems different in that way. Are we doing what we need to be doing?
I think to a certain extent we're bringing the spotlight to it, but I don't think there's enough people doing the groundwork.
Yeah. Meaning what?
Getting down and dirty, the stuff that you don't want to do, facing, you know.
Face-to-face talks about what this experience was like.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm just wondering, you know, the extent to which, Cindy, you could reach out and get so many more veterans involved in a program like this. I imagine the number is just could be extraordinary if you wanted it to be.
I would hope so, that we would be able to draw upon more vets and family members into the process. You know, one of the things that that I would echo in Nick's work and Dolores's work is that a lot of times when you're writing poetry or prose, it gives you more control over the situation that you're in. I know that for me, some of my memories were quite haunting, and there would be opportunities where they would just appear and just, I wouldn't say paralyze you, but certainly you would be thinking about them. And I have found that by writing and going through the revision process, it gives you more control over those memories. And one of our mentors in the program, H.C. Palmer, always says, you can change the ending if you want to.
Meaning?
You can change the ending of the story that might have ended poorly or in a negative way, and you can change it to be positive in your mind and in your writing.
Well, what's the hardest thing for the vets to sort of get past as they do this kind of writing? I mean, what's the biggest hurdle? Is it navigating the language, or is it more of an emotional thing?
For me, I would think that the most difficult barrier is just to be able to do it. How many times have you heard someone say, and not just a vet, but just anyone say, oh, gosh, I have a great idea for a book, and I know I need to write it. Well, they never sit down and write it. Mm-hmm. And so I think the same thing for a vet or a family member. is to be able to say, I want to do this. I want to make the investment in time, because as we know, there was an investment that they had to make to be able to participate in the program. And then, you know, we'll teach you the skills to write.
Right.
And then the critique process, because that's an important part. Nobody writes something down the first time and it's perfect and we all love it. I mean, sometimes my work, I probably revise 25 or 30 times before I'm actually like, okay, I think this is good enough. So, you know, sometimes the deadlines say, okay, you got to give it up. But, you know, it's that sort of thing, is getting past that, making the investment, being willing to listen and take in the critique. And then
that can be hard.
Yes, it can be.
Listen,
it can be very hard.
As a guy who tried to put words on paper for a living, I know how hard that is.
Exactly. Yeah. And then I think removing the fear of, and you touched on it, the emotional side of things. And we have had people break down and in tears in our critique sessions and in our workshops, and that's okay. You know, that's what we're there for, is to help you. And then if you need additional assistance, we can help you off to the side too. You know, we can talk with you and talk you through what you're going through.
Well, Dolores, I was struck a little while ago, you were saying that sometimes you were surprised at how quickly the words came to you, and that bleeding out some of these things maybe wasn't as tough as you thought it might be.
Well, yes. But one thing I did realize is that during, as she was, Cindy was saying, during our critiquing sessions, someone else reads your work. And when I'm reading it, it's sort of an insulation. So for me, when someone read my poem, it gives emotions that I didn't even realize that I had.
How about for you, Nick? What was the big challenge you faced here?
I think just acceptance.
Acceptance of?
This is where I am at in life. That was the past, and I have the future and the present. I think I learned recently in a group that I go to at the VA, pain plus acceptance is pain. Pain plus resistance is suffering.
Oh, that's interesting. That's an interesting idea, isn't it?
I wish I would have learned that a long time ago.
Yeah. Do you really?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. You have another poem you bought here. It's called Mudsuck.
The Mudsuck. We safeguard this forsaken place for the preservation of its heart, a single 9,800-foot runway. Desert nights come alive as we scan for enemies with headlights of Humvees. C-130 turboprop engines deafen our ears. Sounds of visitors delivering presents, MREs, cigarettes, and letters from the outside world. With our bare hands, we clean up this muddied landscape. Gator landmines exposed from the rain, dropped out of the sky in cluster bombs, left behind and forgotten from past wars, their purpose never realized, to destroy and kill those who dare to challenge democracy.
You call it Mudsuck. Why?
So this was a FOB Madiasis in Iraq. It was our first FOB that we were stationed at when I was deployed. And when it rained, it just, the whole landscape would be muddy, and you know, our Humvees would get stuck, and it was just mud and mud for miles, as you could see.
Just a wonderful place.
Yes.
It sounds incredible. Yeah. Dolores, you brought one called Witnessing.
Yes, Witnessing. They speak of the two soon departed, silenced, unforgotten, dead, remembered, in between times before rounds whizzing by, the bush, the rain, the snakes, the spiders, the salty smell of fear. They speak in the minutes, hours, days, and months go by. I am there in the bush, in the war, in their experience, caught in the repetition of how it was, how it is for them and for me, the listener to this awful soliloquy.
Wow. Again, if you're joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're visiting with veterans who have taken part in a writing program, a Veteran Readers Theater, it's been called. Again, they'll be sharing their poetry and prose tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock, Tuesday evening at the Plaza Library. To RSVP or to get more information, just go to kclibrary.org. Why did you pick poetry to tell your story as opposed to more conventional prose?
I think for me, because I'm so used to saying things short and succinctly, mm-hmm. poetry was a lot easier for me to just pack the words and the emotion together.
You're more of a woman of few words?
Yes.
I'm getting that impression. You speak very concisely. That's all good. Hey, how about for you, Nick?
I just don't have the patience for fiction. I like to say it short and sweet, like Dolores said. And poetry is, it's more musical.
And it packs a lot more wallop sometimes, too, doesn't it? I mean, you forget sometimes how powerful it can be. So what impact, how has this helped you going through all this? How has it changed you?
Like I mentioned before with the acceptance part, I think it's a tool that I've used to move towards that acceptance.
Mm-hmm. How about for you?
It has helped me remember a lot of things that I'd long since forgotten. And
Were they better left forgotten or not?
I think that they are good memories because the men that I spent my time with in Germany, they were all Vietnam veterans. And what I didn't realize is sitting in the office with them, I was actually going through therapy with them. And that was something that I never realized that I had picked up a few skills on counseling mm-hmm. that I didn't know that I had.
So how often do you write now?
This is really my first writing experience.
But have you kept it up at home when you're in your private time?
I've written a few things since then. Yes. So it's opened up a new avenue for expression.
Yeah. How about you, Nick? Are you writing on your own now?
Yes. I try to sit down and do something every day.
Yeah.
Kind of a therapy session by myself.
How long will you go when you do that? How long?
Oh, it varies.
Yeah.
5 minutes to an hour.
Some days it's there and some days it's not, right?
Yes.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. Well, again, for our listeners, you can go see these veterans reading their poetry and hear them tomorrow night at 7. More information, kclibrary.org. I want to thank Nick Lopez, a Marine, a veteran, and a poet now, Dolores Mays, a member of the Army, and now also a poet, Cindy McDermott, who helped organize all this. Thank you both all very much. I sure appreciate it. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
On Friday's program, Why Families Can't Afford America Anymore, from high child care costs to harsh employment policies, many middle-class couples can't afford to raise children. You can hear my conversation with Alyssa Quart and other previous programs. You'll find them at kcur.org/uptodate. Later this week on Up to Date, most European democracies have third parties and fourth parties and fifth. So why is it so hard to start a viable new party here in this country? That'll be Wednesday on Up to Date. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.